This week on Making Contact.
There's no modern day equivalent to the civil rights movement.
The 1960 lunch counter sit-in suddenly catapulted civil rights into the nation's consciousness. But they weren't just spontaneous protests. They came after years of planning and studying techniques of nonviolent civil disobedience. The chief architect of the strategy was James Lawson, who worked alongside Martin Luther King Jr. and was with him only hours before King was killed.
The politics of assassination in the 1960s changed our country forever.
On this edition, we sit down with Reverend James Lawson to get his reflections on the past and his assessment of the current movements for justice in the U.S. I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. Let's start there in the 1960s. And this is an opinion, you can tell me if I'm wrong, but I think a lot of people would say that since the 1960s, we haven't really seen in the U.S. a massive, effective mobilization that worked on really any issue. I guess, obviously, do you think that's true? And if so, how come?
Yes, and there are other people who acknowledge that. Harrison Ford, the actor, has been involved in environmental issues in... Harrison Ford says something like this: I am seeing the failure of the environmental movement because of the way in which we work from issue to issue, species to species. Then he said what the environmental movement needs is a movement like the civil rights movement of some years ago. What he is saying, what lots of people, you can say the peace movement has failed. I would say that such mobilizations as like at Democratic or Republican conventions in which I've participated, or Seattle, or some of the mobilizations that the anti-Iraq war has tried to do, have also failed. That what is needed is what I call a protracted struggle, organizing around nonviolent assessment, investigation, focusing in on a target, and then a protracted struggle with maybe a decade or two decades of intense activity that does not depend upon congressional legislation being passed, but rather forces upon a city or a nation the agenda of justice and truth.
Sounds like you don't think there is a modern-day equivalent of the civil rights movement, right?
Not at all. Not at all. There's no modern-day equivalent to the civil rights movement.
What do you say to those who try to say, oh, the immigrants' rights movement is the equivalent, or the gay rights movement is the equivalent?
Gay rights movement is mostly a lobbying, getting laws passed. It is not a movement where there are tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of people in the street who are demanding change or demanding justice with an agenda that they put on the nation's mind. That's not what they're doing. They're doing much more lobbying behind the scenes, trying to stop some elections, which they have not done that successfully, and it's not been that effective in my judgment.
And do you think these movements aren't effective because... Do you think the right strategy exists and they're refusing to see it, or
they just haven't found it? I don't think they have the right strategy. I think in the first instance, they're not working from a nonviolent perspective and methodology, theory and practice. Secondly, they're not taking the time to assess what they need to be doing or what needs to be corrected, and then settling on a single issue out of that and working on it. And thirdly, they're not mobilizing in terms of direct action that dramatizes the issue and helps to change the public mind, both about the wrong and about the possibility of correction or restructuring or reform or transformation. I think there is far more action today, but I think that far more action over a greater numbers of issues has failed, one, because of the lack of serious nonviolent study and commitment and processing. But secondly, it has been a failure because it has not even persuaded some of the activist leaders that there is a connection between, for example, racism and sexism. The women's movement cannot decide that they will have to perhaps abandon major white male demands of domination and control and abandon their racism if they're going to get at the problem of sexism. That racism and sexism and violence and plantation capitalism are interrelated to each other. In other words, what the principle of what I call convergence, in which in the movement, Dr. King suggested this, there was a gradual awareness that you had the issues of racism, as he called it. You had the issues of poverty, which is a part of what racism is, structural poverty. That's what slavery was. And the issue of militarization of the nation. And his sense that all three of these had to be dismantled in order for a new democratic society of justice and truth to emerge. Well, all through American history, there has been an inability on the part of all sorts of reformers to see the connection between the reform they want, let's say labor unions, and racism, or racism and sexism, or sexism and the violence of the society. They've not been able to see these interlocking. They have not been able to see them as twin or parallel systems of denial and oppression for some people, and therefore recognize that they can't resolve them separately, that any effective work against racism is going to also dismantle sexism, that any effective work for racism and sexism will dismantle the structural forms as well as the spiritual forms of violence, and must.
So is the Poor People's Campaign that Dr. King was working on, is that an example of convergence? I mean, had it happened already, or is it beginning to happen at that point?
He was very clearly trying to get the peace movement to see that the issues of poverty, economic deprivation, are connected to the issues of justice, which is connected clearly to the issue of peace. So it was a form of the emerging convergence that he recognized, that many of us recognize, in the movement of which he was the symbol.
What is plantation capitalism? You mentioned that a minute ago.
Well, I maintain that capitalism in the United States began essentially through the taking of the land from the Indian, compounded then by 250 years of plantations, slavery, the worker as commodity and property and not as human being. And thirdly, by the way in which the Constitution treated issues of the woman in American society, that it was plantation capitalism that solidified racism and made it a system. Plantation capitalism, therefore, is the repetition of the theory of those eras in terms of economics and business and workers and profits and the use of capital. So where over the last 20 years, more than 50% of the new jobs that Republicans and Democrats have bragged about have been poverty jobs, where we applaud, among other things, a surplus labor force because it keeps the wages down. Now, where wages are poor so that workers cannot sustain themselves or their families, cannot therefore be that influential in their neighborhoods about their own environment, that is a direct linkage with the 250 years of slavery. Where the Wall Street Journal insists upon a major goal for the economy is to help people become billionaires, and millionaires. That's an accumulation of wealth. That means that in order to gather that wealth quickly, or even in over a 10-year period, you must fight to see to it that the workers are not sharing in the benefits of their labor. So all of that is what I describe as plantation capitalism. When you allow wealth to accumulate in such a way that you drive out family-owned businesses and farms, and you produce these huge corporations that in many ways are unmanageable, but who dictate the notion that the major purpose for our corporation is turning a profit and growing that profit, you have what I think to be plantation capitalism. Now, I differ with this tremendously. I think that in case, for example, of my medical dollar, that ought to provide a good living for all the people connected with the practice of medicine, including the janitors, the doctors, the nurses, the paramedical people, the lab, all of those people. But I do not believe that my health dollar should be used to make a family that uses venture capitalism to buy up hospitals millionaires. I don't mind folk who become very affluent and wealthy in various ways in our economy, but I do mind where that's at the expense of the folk who do the labor, who do the work.
You just talked about health care, which this past year has been a big issue in the United States. One of the things Dr. King had been talking about was sit-ins in hospitals or around hospitals until everyone got care. So with that in mind, do you think if he hadn't been assassinated, where do you think things might have gone? Do you think some of these battles we're fighting today could have been won 30 or 40 years ago?
The politics of assassination in the 1960s changed our country forever. Two distressful things that happened. One is that when a society, when a people like our people, the nation, the United States, produces young men like John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy and Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, and Martin Luther King, who I do not say were perfect products of humanity, but they were people who were emerging in their humanity, in their vision, in their ability to work with society for creative life. When a nation allows such people to be killed off, you do more damage to your nation than you can even imagine. And the people who plotted this, and there were people who plotted it in high and low places, they had every notion concerning domination and control and not benefiting our land. Secondly, those assassinations did mean that, number one, the movement of which King had become a symbol, direct action on the part of the people withdrawing their consent from racism and from violence, and the people organizing themselves to put a justice agenda or a freedom agenda in the White House or in Congress or in the governor's mansions. That movement got shortchanged and did not have this opportunity to develop into maturity. But on the one side, you had folk who were appointed and elected to offices, and the other side, folk who were coming out of grassroots mass mobilization and action. A perfect combination for serious change in a nation. And so all of that was destroyed.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. We now return to an interview with Reverend James Lawson, It took place in February 2010 in Mérida, Mexico, at the Narco News School of Authentic Journalism.
Obviously, you're fierce is the right word, but a proponent of nonviolence. We're here in Mexico, and you've heard a little bit from some people here who've said, you know, their heroes are guerrilla armies or people who participated in armed revolutions that they feel led to the liberation of their people. To bring it a little closer to the United States, there are stories of slave rebellions, armed slave rebellions, where it was not nonviolent, and yet people achieved at least some semblance of freedom. How do you respond to those people who point to examples like that?
Well, in the first instance, my great grandfather was a slave. And anyone who pretends that there were slave revolts that were successful are quite mistaken. There were lots of them, no doubt. There were a lot of other forms of revolt. But the Nat Vesey struggle around 1830, 1832, the Nat Turner rebellion, development of violence in Virginia in 1830 did not succeed, and almost all the leadership, those are the two best known examples of a slave revolt. And all of the leadership and many innocent people in both Virginia and Charleston, South Carolina, were stamped out and wiped out. In the meantime, the Underground Railroad was far more successful in getting people out from under slavery. That's the route my own great-grandfather took. Then secondly, the revolt of people like Frederick Douglass, who as a boy against the law learned how to read, and at different points was even taught by his mistress. The revolt of Owen Brown, who became an accountant on his plantation in South Carolina. The revolt of the people who, in contradiction oftentimes of the wishes of the master, honed their skills so that they could leave or so they could acquire skills that would benefit them in the long run. That was a far greater revolt and did more to free up slaves than did any of the slave revolts. So I think that there is today a revision of the black experience that could be insidious, but I think it's quite wrong. Then there's only, to my knowledge, there's only one guerrilla warfare in Central Latin America that produced serious change, and that was Fidel Castro. I mean, look, Colombia, the units in Colombia have been fighting for 40, 50 years, and it's the people of Colombia who do the suffering, both from the oligarchy and American militarism, as well as from the so-called guerrilla units. And the thing about Fidel Castro is that his people and he did have the skill of organizing in such a fashion that the U.S. Army, in the form of Batista, surrendered and fled. But what is not talked about is that then Castro fundamentally changed his perspective to essentially a nonviolent perspective. He said, I'm going to eradicate racism and segregation. The revolution will eradicate infant mortality rates in Cuba. We are going to eradicate illiteracy. We're going to help people go to work in these fields whereby they can make a living. The only handicap that Castro's Cuba has had has been the Castro, has been the antagonism and the overt acts of invasion and assault by the United States government. His government, his people, his Cuba would be a model for the whole world were it not for the United States.
So what does that say then? Does that say, well, violent revolution is okay if you have a really good leader who sticks to his values?
No, I don't think so. I think it says that even if you can develop a violent revolution as Castro did, a military revolution, that overthrows the tyrant, you, if you're going to be effective, you must turn to developing a nation that is whole, that it dismantles the injustices, that tries to educate the people to see themselves as human beings who can excel and who can solve their problems. And what has too often happened with guerrilla warfare is that guerrilla warfare becomes obsessive, like military stuff becomes an obsession, a pathology, no longer has any merit for solving the human condition or healing the human condition.
You seem to be saying, no, violence is never okay. And then you're saying, well, in this one case, it turned out okay.
No, but I'm saying something more than that, that the folk who have these notions about the efficacy of violence can only point to a Fidel Castro and that movement. But I'm not saying, therefore, that was justified. One could even say that maybe Castro's violence is what, in turn, also then re-triggered American violence. And so it escalated rather than de-escalated. So he lost his chance. And I'm not justifying American violence. I think it's wrong and is serious evil and serious sin. I am saying that people who want a better world had better look at the role of violence, behavioral violence, organized violence, systemic violence, and recognize that in the last 100 years, maybe with the exception of World War II, violence, whether organized in war or informal, is the leading enemy of justice and peace in the world today. It not only devastates in all sorts of ways, it's not only has escalated the arms race and the militarization of life, but it has also then deprived civilian human enterprises of the resources needed to solve problems. I figured out recently that my nation has probably spent somewhere between 28 and 35 or 40 trillion dollars on the military since World War II. Now, I wonder if half of that had been used on helping the human race sustain itself with food, or finding ways to stop the pollution of the waters and the air. I wonder if just half of that had been spent on wiping out illiteracy in the world. I mean, just for a moment, wonder if that the same numbers of scientists been working on the weapons had been working over the last 40 or 50 years on human situations. Is there anybody who doesn't have the good enough sense to recognize we'd have a far better world? I mean, it seems to me that this picture of violence is not being artistically sketched anywhere publicly to get people to really see what is going on in their world.
And one more question about the efficacy of nonviolence. Some others said, well, you know, in my country here in Latin America, people have tried that and they're getting mowed down by the thousands. It's not working. We're too many people are dying. We need to try something else. What do you tell them?
Well, okay. But if I understand things rightly, the emergence of Hugo Chavez is the emergence, essentially, of a nonviolent approach to politics. And, you know, after all, he didn't just rise up out of Venezuela as a kind of a explosion of a bomb. He has been in his society an organizer of all kinds of people's movements for 20 or 30 years. Eva Morales has been organizing for many years. What's his name in Brazil? Had been on the scene for 30 years trying to organize people for political social change. Those are at least three illustrations in the contemporary scene. Jean Baptiste Aristide of Haiti is another one. They all were organizing 10, 20, 30 years before they came to power. on the backs, usually, of a sizable percentage of their population that saw them as their own spokesperson. So that was not a violent way of doing it. That was primarily of nonviolent perspective, nonviolent organizing. And that's part of the great hope now in the 21st century that has scared our military intelligence and our White House and our State Department and Pentagon to death in the United States. How many more of those people are going to be raised up?
I want to just get back to the Martin Luther King holiday. We hear every year the same sound bites, I have a dream, and I'm sure I don't have to tell you that a large percentage of what Dr. King stood for is, it's not forgotten, but it's certainly not taught. Anti-war, organizing poor people, and all these other issues. How does that make you feel to see kind of the very narrow version of the story that's being taught to children and even adults?
I think the problem in the United States is that the white counterparts in the United States for social change and the white counterparts in the peace movement, the labor movement, the justice movement, the educational movement, they are not uniting with the black community to make Martin Luther King's Day a holiday, national holiday, on behalf of justice and human rights. I think that's the problem. Where are the white political figures getting underneath this, helping to create the holiday in a fashion that will impact the nation or the city? They're not there. That's our biggest problem. The biggest problem is that the so-called white left or progressive community in the United States has divorced itself from seeing King as anything more than a facade, and not the movement that he represented, the new foreign policy that he represented, and getting underneath celebrating the holiday in a fashion that makes it an integral part of American history and an integral part of the future struggles. The media is always going to domesticate issues in the United States. But here it is. We have a holiday that celebrates the struggle of a people to end Jim Crow segregation, poverty, injustice, police brutality, the whole range of it, to paint the Constitution as a Constitution of including all of us. These are some of the things that that movement did. That affects all humankind. Why are not the women's organizations in full support of that? After all, it was the work of the Constitution that, among other things, it said that the Constitution embraces women as well in the 20th century, initiated by the NAACP. So why are not the women's organizations out there in front trying to organize the celebration around the weekend of King Holiday as a celebration of the progress that we, the American people, have made towards egalitarian society, but of the work that we have yet to do?
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. You've been listening to an interview with civil rights leader and nonviolence tactician James Lawson. You can hear the full-length version on our website, radioproject.org. That's also where to go to find our podcast, download past shows, or help make a difference by supporting our work. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.